KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Israel's Security Cabinet has approved a ceasefire deal with Hamas. The full cabinet is expected to vote later today. Will Sunday see a pause in fighting? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Next week, Kamala Harris leaves her office as vice president. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. So what's next for the woman many Americans had hoped would be the first woman president? Is hiring private firefighters to protect homes from wildfires only an option for the uber rich? And from the archives of StoryCorps, the late civil rights leader Lonnie C. King shares a story about his friend Martin Luther King Jr. It's Friday, January 17th. Happy birthday to former First Lady Michelle Obama. She's 61 today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel's Security Cabinet has voted today to approve the proposed ceasefire deal with Hamas. The move is an important step, though not yet a final one, towards stopping the fighting in Gaza. NPR's Greg Myrie reports the ceasefire could take effect as soon as Sunday.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Security Cabinet gave its blessing to the ceasefire deal. The proposal now goes to the full Israeli cabinet, where it's expected to win approval despite opposition from some hardline ministers. The deal could take effect as early as Sunday, though it may be delayed a day or so. The first phase of the agreement would bring a halt to the fighting. Hamas would release 33 hostages, and Israel would free around 1,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. Meanwhile, Israel is pressing ahead with airstrikes in Gaza. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed since the ceasefire agreement was announced Wednesday. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President-elect Trump's nominee to lead the Department of Homeland Security is appearing this hour for her Senate confirmation hearing. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem is a strong supporter of Trump's border policies. Yesterday, Trump's choice for Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent had his hearing. NPR's Maria Aspen reports.
The Treasury Secretary is the president's top advisor on economic policy. And Bessent showed up ready to defend President-elect Trump's plan for the U.S. economy. Bessent was particularly enthusiastic about renewing the tax cuts that Trump first passed in 2017 and that are due to expire this year.
This is the single most important economic issue of the day. This is pass-fail.
Many economists have warned that these tax cuts, along with Trump's proposed tariffs, could restart inflation and make the federal deficit soar. But Bessent repeatedly downplayed these concerns. He said in response to one question about Trump's economic policies that, quote, nothing I can immediately think of would increase inflation. Maria Aspen, NPR News.
Fire crews are making progress against the two huge wildfires burning in the Los Angeles region. The Eaton Fire north of the city is 65% contained. The Palisades Fire west of LA is 27% contained. One of the lead agencies investigating the Palisades Fire is the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. ATF Director Steve Dettelbach says agents are trying to find out how it started.
They'll look at burn patterns. They'll look at whether there's one place where the fire started or several places where the fire started. They'll look at chemistry, and they'll just go out and do independent lead investigation. They'll look at camera footage. They'll talk to the people all around the area.
He spoke to CNN. The fires have killed at least 25 people. On Wall Street, the Dow is now up more than 340 points. This is NPR. President Biden has declared he now considers the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution, quote, the law of the land. Backers plan to rally today in front of the National Archives. The amendment would need to be formally published or certified to come into effect by the National Archivist. It's not clear if or when that'll happen. The 1970s-era amendment passed by Congress would guarantee men and women equal rights under the law, but it took until 2020 for enough state legislatures to ratify it, missing a deadline set by Congress. Brazil's highest court has denied former President Jair Bolsonaro's request to leave the country to attend Donald Trump's inauguration. Julia Canero reports from Rio de Janeiro.
Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, had requested permission from the Supreme Court to travel to Trump's inauguration next week. Bolsonaro's passport was seized last February because of investigations into whether he tried to stage a coup after losing re-election in 2022. Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes denied his request for this trip, arguing there was risk he would try to flee the country and evade justice. Bolsonaro is a fan of Trump and a strong right-wing ally in South America. This week, he told the New York Times he was, quote, feeling like a kid again with Trump's invite. Bolsonaro says his team will appeal the decision. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in Rio.
And this just in, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a federal law that will ban TikTok. That ban is effective this Sunday. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Israel's Security Cabinet has now voted to approve a ceasefire deal to halt the fighting in Gaza. The decision came 2 days after mediators Qatar and the United States said an agreement had been reached that both Israel and Hamas representatives agreed to. The full Israeli cabinet will meet later today to consider the deal. And if it is approved, it would halt more than 15 months of fighting in Gaza.
The meeting comes 2 days after mediators announced this agreement and a day after some ministers in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet renewed their calls to continue the war in Gaza. The stops and starts of negotiations has people like 21-year-old Shema Ahmed in Gaza afraid to hope just in case the deal falls through.
We really want it to be over. We're desperate to hear that it's finally and actually over so that we can continue moving on with our life.
With me now is NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv to walk us through the latest. Hi, Kat.
Hey there.
Okay, so it's past the Israeli Security Cabinet. Does this now make it a done deal?
Not quite. So we're waiting on a vote later today by the larger Israeli government, but it is expected to pass there with a majority of the votes. It is possible that it could still be challenged in Israel's Supreme Court. It's expected to make it through that too, though. So there are a few more steps, but it does seem likely that a ceasefire could start as early as Sunday.
Okay, and what's been the holdup so far in Israel? Although at this point, it seems like those hurdles are over.
Yeah, it's been a tense time here since this deal was passed by mediator or was announced by mediators back in on Wednesday night. It was announced by Egypt, Qatar, and the U.S. and even Hamas back then, but Israel did not confirm it. Netanyahu's office put out a statement saying that Hamas had come back with last-minute changes to the deal that still had to be worked out, and Hamas denied that. So it was a little unclear what the holdup was exactly. And meanwhile, there has been a disagreement within Israel's security cabinet. Two far-right members were very, very against this deal. Both of them threatened to leave Netanyahu's government if the deal did go through, and that would collapse his coalition and throw Israel's government into a tailspin. You know, it seems like those that has been a bit smoothed out, although both of those ministers did vote against the deal in the Security Cabinet vote this morning.
Now, you said the ceasefire should start Sunday as expected. What will those first hours, that first day look like, and what happens after that?
We know several Israeli hostages will be released that first day in exchange for several Palestinian detainees. We also know that the fighting will stop in Gaza and Israeli troops will start to withdraw. The plan is for it to stop for at least 6 weeks. Over that time, 33 of the remaining 98 hostages should be released, and around 1,000 Palestinian detainees are also expected to be released. There's also supposed to be a significant increase in the flow of much-needed humanitarian aid to Gaza. And also in that time, negotiations for the next phase of this deal will also take place in the hopes of, you know, continuing the ceasefire with more releases and more withdrawal of Israeli troops.
Okay, so not an end to the war, but a pause for now.
Yeah.
But right now, there isn't a ceasefire. What's happening in Gaza?
Yeah, the fighting is very much still ongoing. Israel says it carried out around 50 airstrikes in the past day. It says it killed a Hamas fighter who participated in the 2023 attacks on southern Israel that started this war. Meanwhile, more than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the time since this deal was announced on Wednesday night, many of them children, according to civil defense in Gaza. So, you know, the cost, the human cost of keeping this war going is still very, very high. Our producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, says that people there are feeling anxious. They're worried that the fighting is going to get worse before it gets better.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.
President Biden gave the traditional farewell speech to the nation this week. Last night, Kamala Harris took part in a ritual observed by outgoing vice presidents. One of the last things she'll do in her history-making time in office. NPR's Deepa Shivaram looks at what comes next for Harris.
Vice President Harris sat down at her ceremonial desk on Thursday. The desk looks normal, but its top drawer carries a special tradition.
I stand in a long tradition as the 49th Vice President of the United States, in a long tradition of vice presidents who have signed this desk, and I do so with great honor.
Vice presidents since the 1940s have signed the drawer.
With that, I'm going to pull out the Sharpie.
Harris added her name next to past VPs like Lyndon Johnson and Joe Biden, too. She's the first woman to sign her name there, capping off her historic 4 years in office, serving as the country's first woman vice president. But she told her staff there is still work to be done.
And as you all know me, because we have spent long hours, long days and months and years together, it is not my nature to go quietly into the night. So don't worry about that.
Harris's term isn't ending the way she had hoped. Had she won the election in November, Harris would be packing up to move into the West Wing. But instead, she spent the last few weeks packing up and attending to constitutional duties in Washington. By the time Inauguration Day arrives, boxes of materials from her 4 years in office will head to the National Archives, and the vice president herself will move to Los Angeles. Harris is leaving office in a fairly unique position. Her national profile was boosted over the course of her short presidential run last year. She has a higher approval rating now than when she launched her campaign, though it is lower than when she first came into office. And at 60, she's still fairly young for presidential politics.
She's had experiences as vice president and as a presidential candidate that no Democratic figure under the age of 75 or so has had.
That's Joel Goldstein at St. Louis University. He's an expert on the modern vice presidency, and he says Harris is well positioned to run for office again. Goldstein says he thinks Harris effectively has three options for her future: run for governor of California in 2026, run for president in 2028, or what he calls door number three, leave her name off of any future ballots.
Do something else that perhaps didn't involve running for office.
Plans for Harris's future are still being determined, so people close to Harris would only talk about them on the basis of anonymity to protect private conversations. Two Harris aides say she hasn't made any decisions on her options. One source said there hasn't been a full discussion yet. A second source said they feel running for governor would be a step down after serving as vice president. But Harris does intend to stay in the public eye, whether that's in the form of speeches or social media, a third source says, and she's keeping a small group of advisors with her as she decides how to weigh in over the next few months. When she leaves office on January 20th, it will be the first time in more than 20 years that Harris has not been working as a public servant, which will be a big adjustment. Congresswoman Latifah Simon has known Harris for decades. Harris hired her to work in the DA's office in San Francisco. And now Simon is a new member of Congress, representing Oakland, where her old boss grew up. And she says Harris is nowhere close to retiring.
I'm excited for what she's going to do. There's no way, I'm going to repeat it time and time again, that I think she's done. Has she told me what she's going to do? No. But I know this woman, and I know she's just beginning, really.
It won't remain a mystery for long, but if Harris does choose to put her name back on any ballot, one source says Harris will likely have to make those decisions by this summer to begin the work of fundraising and campaigning all over again. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, Washington.
Large swaths of the U.S. are about to get really cold.
That's because an Arctic blast is forecast to sweep down through Canada and blow through the Rockies on its way to the East Coast. In some places, temperatures could plunge as low as minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit with wind chill. Donald Trump's inauguration ceremony in Washington, D.C. on Monday is expected to be the coldest in 40 years.
Joining me to talk about what to expect is Andrew Friedman, senior climate reporter at Axios. Hi, Andrew. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I'm already cold and now an Arctic blast. What even is an Arctic blast?
So this is essentially a large push of air coming in right straight from Siberia over the pole. Through parts of Canada and then across the U.S. border, probably crossing the U.S.-Canadian border sometime later today, and then spilling southward and eastward over time over the course of several days.
Okay. How is this different from that other winter weather phenomenon that sounds hypothermic-inducing, a polar vortex?
Yeah, so this is actually related to the polar vortex.
Okay.
So the polar vortex is really an area of low pressure that forms in the upper atmosphere, in an area of the upper atmosphere that nobody really thinks about. We don't really fly there in airplanes. It's pretty high. And it is, when it is strong, it bottles up the cold air over the Arctic. When it is weak, some of that cold air spills out. Now, one of the unique things about this year compared to the polar vortex winter of 2013-2014 is the polar vortex is very strong right now, but it's also stretched and elongated, and a piece of it is coming down towards the United States. And then if you look at the lower atmosphere, kind of what's happening is the polar vortex is communicating in a way with the jet stream, which is a phenomenon that most of us are more familiar with. So it's forcing that jet stream southward into the U.S., kind of all the way down towards Texas.
Now, I joke about, oh, I'm so cold, but I mean, this kind of weather can be really dangerous and really damaging, right? Already before the Arctic blast comes, places like D.C. are having issues with freezing pipes, and other parts of the country are dealing with the same thing. What infrastructure challenges do these cold snaps present?
Yeah, we had a water main break on my street in Maryland. There is water infrastructure, electrical infrastructure that we worry about. Obviously, the power concerns with the grid in Texas and elsewhere will come up. However, the concerns aren't quite as high as they have been in the past, largely because of work that's been done since previous events. But the cold is dangerous. We are going to see quite a significant wind chills, quite significant danger for hypothermia and frostbite, especially in the Plain States and the upper Midwest, particularly Monday to Wednesday.
That's Andrew Friedman, senior climate reporter at Axios. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Colson Whitehead's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Nickel Boys, has been adapted for the big screen. On the next Fresh Air, we'll listen back to our 2019 interview with him when his novel was just published. It's set in the early 60s, based on the true story of the Dozier Reform School in Florida, where many boys were beaten and sexually abused. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights. Supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Amid the devastation in Los Angeles, a little-known industry has come into the spotlight: private firefighters. Here to tell us more about this is NPR's Laurel Wamsley. Hi, Laurel.
Hey, Leila.
So, Laurel, the only time I'd ever heard about private firefighters, if you remember a wildfire a few years ago in the Los Angeles area where Kim Kardashian and her husband at the time, Kanye West, hired private firefighters to save their homes, and it sounded like something only for the most wealthy.
Right. So these are back in the news here in Los Angeles, and a lot of the attention is stemming from this single tweet that's now been deleted. Last week, a resident of the wealthy Pacific Palisades area posted on X asking if anyone had access to private firefighters who could protect his home as his neighbors' homes were burning. He said he would, quote, pay any amount. And of course, there was a lot of blowback to that idea. It struck a lot of folks as unfair and just crummy. And so there have been media reports of billionaires hiring private firefighters to protect their homes and businesses. But of course, many wealthy people did lose their homes in these fires. I found that a much bigger part of this story is actually not the individuals hiring extra fire protection, but that insurers are hiring them as part of people's homeowners policies.
Oh, okay. That's something I didn't know. Insurance companies were doing this. What exactly do these services do?
Yeah, so I spoke with David Torgerson. He's executive chairman of Wildfire Defense Companies, and they work on behalf of nearly three dozen insurers, and they're regulated under California law. So when there's a wildfire endangering homes insured by these companies, his crews arrive loaded with water, but most of what they provide is labor.
We clean, we sweep, we clear gutters, we take away the places where the embers can ignite on the property, or take away the access that the embers have to get in the buildings.
Embers can get into a house through the dryer vent, so his crews will tape those shut. They'll also come back after the fire passes to make sure there isn't a bush or a fence that's burning that could still ignite the house.
So for the insurance companies, they are paying for these firefighters, but is this about limiting their losses by the much larger expense of properties burning down in the first place?
It's about prevention rather than having to pay for replacing all those lost homes. So more and more insurers are including this as a standard part of their homeowners policies in wildfire-prone states.
How does this work? Does a truck full of trained firefighters and water just show up to protect homes that have these specific insurers and then just ignore everybody who doesn't have those insurers?
Well, it's obviously sort of hard to know exactly what happens in the field. When I asked a spokesperson at the insurer USAA that question, she said the providers that they work with don't just drive on by a house that's on fire, that they're staffed with a lot of retired fire chiefs, and it's just embedded in them to help the community. But still, private companies obviously might have different priorities than firefighters who work for the public.
Okay, so stepping back, does this just mean that rich people or people with the right coverage get a separate lane from the rest of people?
Yeah, I mean, I asked an ethics expert about this, and he said there are a whole host of ethical questions here. For instance, which firefighters get access to limited water supplies? It can be really divisive in society when it feels like even in a crisis, the rich and powerful get insulated from what's happening. And I asked Torgerson about this, who runs that company that works for the insurers. And he said, well, in a crisis, we need all the help we can get, and it's better to have more structures survive. They're helping to keep insurance in the marketplace, he says, which has been a huge problem in California in recent years. So these are big questions, and there are no easy answers.
NPR's Laurel Wamsley. Thank you, Laurel.
You're welcome.
It is Friday, and so that's time again for StoryCorps. Ahead of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we have a story from Atlanta, King's hometown. It was 1960, and the presidential race pitted Vice President Richard Nixon against Senator John F. Kennedy.
70,000-plus African-American students were saying, "Freedom now." But it was as if it was happening on Mars, because neither one of those running for office ever mentioned what was happening all over the South.
So civil rights leader Lonnie C. King enlisted the help of his childhood friend, Martin Luther King Jr.
I planned to put the movement on the front pages of the newspapers around the world, and the best way to do that was to try to get King to go to jail with us. Now, he had promised through his father that he wouldn't get involved in the activities that were going on in Atlanta, because Atlanta did not need him, as his father saw it. Daddy King was against us. Still, when we planned the boycott of downtown Atlanta, I called Mr. Martin to ask him would he go, because I'd known him since 1945. And so he was giving me all the very erudite kinds of reasons. And I said, ML, I was LC and he was ML. I said, wait a minute, now you can't leave from the back. You got to leave from the front. The reason I chose to tell him that was because his daddy used to preach that. I said, Atlanta is your hometown, capital of the South, and I need you to go with me. He said, okay, I'll be there. He went to jail with us that morning on the 19th of October, and we had about 200 people who went to jail that day. They had to go and get some spare bunks from other counties in order to have space for us. Now, King's arrest did exactly what I thought it was going to do, because it was in a national story, and so the Kennedys got involved, and they put out 11 million flyers that they called the Blue Bomb all over America to black churches. So John Kennedy was given the credit for interceding in the release of King. And Kennedy beat Nixon with 70% of the black vote. You know, democracy is not a state of being that you're automatically born into. You have to work constantly to try to sustain it, because there are always people around who want to minimize democracy for a certain set of people.
Well, in the midst of all that, what gives you hope?
Well, I think the glass is half full, not half empty. And that's what keeps me going.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my body is 79, but my mind is 25.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking and planning and working on what I've been doing most of my life. That's my calling as I saw it, and I haven't veered too far from that.
Lonnie C. King, speaking with his friend, Sarah Cook. Lonnie King died in 2019. He was 82 years old.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. And from Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
The Palisades Fire destroyed more than 2,800 homes and buildings. One of them was the historic ranch house of Will Rogers, the vaudeville entertainer and trick roper.
There were some key things owned by Will, like his, you know, his boots, his typewriter. There was, you know, gifts that were really rare gifts made to the family.
We take stock of what's left on All Things Considered.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The U.S. Supreme Court is upholding a federal law that bans TikTok nationwide unless the video app is sold by its Chinese parent company, ByteDance. The High Court's ruling was unanimous. The law, passed by Congress last year and signed by President Biden, is set to take effect on Sunday. NPR's Bobby Allen reports.
The Supreme Court's decision means there is now a federal law on the books criminalizing the commercial support of the China-based app. Under the law, Apple and Google must remove TikTok from app stores. The web hosting companies have to sever ties with the app, or the companies could face violations of $5,000 per TikTok user. There is no penalty for simply using the app, if using it is even possible. TikTok has said it may hit the kill switch on its servers and send the service black on Sunday. Or the app might make no changes and wait to see what President-elect Donald Trump does. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
TikTok argued the ban violates the First Amendment. Days before he leaves office, President Biden is commuting the sentences of nearly 2,500 people convicted of nonviolent drug offenses. The White House says Biden has issued more individual pardons and commutations than any president in the country's history. Calmer winds and cooler temperatures in Southern California are helping firefighters as they continue battling fires near Los Angeles. This is NPR News. President-elect Donald Trump's choice to lead the Department of Homeland Security is on Capitol Hill this morning. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem is testifying at her Senate confirmation hearing, where she's been highlighting the national security challenges facing the country.
The challenges in front of us are extremely significant, and we must secure our borders against illegal trafficking and immigration. We must safeguard our critical infrastructure to make sure that we're protected against cyber attacks, respond to natural disasters, and also terrorism. I firmly believe that we can meet those challenges.
The two-term Republican governor is testifying to the Senate Homeland Security Committee. Israel's security cabinet has approved a ceasefire and hostage release agreement with Hamas in Gaza. It was announced earlier this week. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf says Israel's full cabinet is expected to okay that deal soon.
The plan is for that fighting to stop for at least 6 weeks. Over that time, 33 of the remaining 98 hostages should be released, and around 1,000 Palestinian detainees are expected to be released as well. There's also supposed to be a significant increase in the flow of much-needed humanitarian aid to Gaza, and also in that time, negotiations for the next phase of this deal will also take place in the hopes of continuing the ceasefire with more releases and the withdrawal of more Israeli troops.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reporting. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Paramount Pictures, presenting the new film September 5. When gunshots are heard in the Olympic Village, broadcast history is made and the whole world is watching, based on a true story now playing. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. This morning, Israel's security cabinet approved a ceasefire deal to halt the fighting in Gaza. The full Israeli cabinet is due to meet later today for a final vote. When President Biden announced the agreement between Israel and Hamas earlier this week, he made a point of thanking his negotiating team, including Amos Hochstein. Hochstein is a longtime diplomat with a focus on energy policy. Soon after Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, triggering the war in Gaza and eventually Lebanon, he also was named U.S. Special Envoy to the region. I sat down with Hochstein yesterday to get a sense of how this deal came together and why it came together now after 15 months of war.
The real game changer was the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah.
And what that did was Hamas kept negotiating in the summer and in the early fall with this idea that there's always another option of continuing to fight and Iran will support them and rearm them and they'll get the cavalry is going to come, the Houthis from Yemen, the Iraqi Shia militias, the Hezbollah forces from the north, most importantly. When Hezbollah did the deal, it meant a few things. Suddenly Israel was fighting a one-front war, not a two-front war. And that was very bad for Hamas. The second was the sense of betrayal. Hezbollah betrayed them. Iran betrayed them. They signed a deal without them. And so suddenly the whole world changed on them. And a few days later, Syria fell, which meant even more pressure on Hamas. So Hamas was suddenly forced to come to the table in a different way than they were before. And the Israeli government suddenly came under pressure from two presidents, from an outgoing and an incoming. And that was the change dynamic here.
Can you give us a sense of what these negotiations have been like? I mean, you're an energy specialist, so you've been in negotiations before about lots of things, but there's a difference between, I think, negotiating over money or infrastructure and negotiating over people's lives, especially given, look, on a scale of 1 to 10, the emotions on both sides here had to be at like 15. So many deaths, atrocities, so much mistrust on both sides already. And can you just give us a sense of what it was like?
So to be clear, I was the point person on the negotiations with Hezbollah, and Brett McGurk has been the point person on the negotiations vis-a-vis Hamas.
Understood.
There's no doubt that corporate negotiations and these kinds of negotiations are fundamentally different. The costs are higher. The meaning behind it is emotional. You meet with relatives of hostages who are sitting there for 460 days or so, and you're meeting with people who tell you that my entire family was wiped out in Gaza. So one, as a mediator and negotiator, as much as you want to, and there's all these protesters in the streets and outside my house and outside the White House and so on, my job is to take that emotion out. You can't negotiate on emotions. The parties have emotions. But as a mediator, if you come in with the emotions, then you're just injecting more uncertainty into it and volatility. The formula has to be, what is it that each side fundamentally needs? Israel needs to know that October 7 can't happen again. And the Palestinians in Gaza need to know that this conflict ends and there's some hope that they will be allowed to rebuild their lives. And the threat of daily bombardment at any moment is gone. But it's taking that emotion out and eventually saying, look, guys, this is the last moment. You have to take status quo off the table. And if you don't agree to this deal now, things get worse for both.
As you are very well aware, there are critics of the administration's whole effort in this area saying that the Biden administration has not demanded enough from Israel, that allowing weapons to continue to go in while so many people were killed, that just the lack of proportionality and so forth. And that sort of a path has been cleared for Israel to act with impunity, given that the president-elect is already seen to be very sympathetic to the Netanyahu regime in Israel. Is there any part of that that you think is fair?
I think that the hard thing about this conflict here is how people view it from here has been that it's been binary. And the criticism that we get is one that you just described. Mm-hmm. Israel's acting with impunity, not enough pressure. And the other criticism is, you're not letting Israel do the job. They've been attacked. Hamas is a terrorist organization. They control Gaza. They use human shields, et cetera, et cetera. The most discouraging part of this job over the last year has been the lack of nuance in both the coverage and the criticism. And criticism is fine, and I accept it. I think we've made mistakes. But by and large, we got to where we are today, the ceasefire, because it was methodical. Mm-hmm. Will President-elect Trump do it differently? Perhaps, and I think some of the criticism against us from the side that said we were allowing Israel to act with impunity may come back to reassess that in the future in comparison. But I think the lessons in the United States that we have to draw from this is we cannot allow ourselves to take conflicts in the Middle East and bring them and turn them into American conflicts. We have to take that step back and say, this is a complicated situation. Is it possible that it's not one side is guilty, one side is pure, but rather this is a very messy war, and our job is to try to get to the end of the war and to try to manage it?
How did you get involved in this to begin with? I mean, you were at the State Department for a long time in the Obama administration. Your portfolio is energy security, right? In the Biden administration, you went to the White House as a special advisor to work on energy and national security. I don't know who woke up and thought, well, gee, this is what I'm going to spend the last like year and a half of my life doing. How did you get involved? And if you don't mind my asking, are you glad that you did? I mean, this has taken, I think, a toll on everybody involved.
My day job is doing energy and infrastructure investment. And because of my energy background, there was a conflict between Israel and Hezbollah that was brewing for years around how to exploit resources offshore. There's an area of water between Israel and Lebanon that was never delineated. So for 40, 50, 60 years, nobody cared. But all of a sudden, those waters became very valuable. And so we had a real threat of conflict. There have been many mediators trying to mediate that over the last 15 years. I was one of them in the Obama administration. I failed like everybody else. But we suddenly got to a point where it was about to go into a kinetic, hard, hot war, where Hezbollah said, if we can't develop resources in Lebanon, we're going to fire at the Israeli offshore. I was asked, hey, it's an energy deal, even though it really wasn't. It was about borders. And I was successful in mediating a boundary between Israel and Lebanon in the water. And so when October 7 happened and Hezbollah joined the war, I had been successful in that. The president asked me if I would try to manage and contain that situation as everybody was handling Gaza. At some point, I advocated that we should flip the script to get the actual ceasefire deal in Lebanon in order to incentivize the one in Gaza. And because these conflicts are so intertwined, it's hard to say I work on Lebanon, but not to work on Gaza, or the people working on Gaza not to be influenced by what's happening in Lebanon. So all of these sort of fit together. Am I glad I did? Yes. The fact that we got the ceasefire, did it take an emotional toll 100%? And being part of this to try to make this better was worth it.
That is Amos Hochstein, senior advisor to President Biden. Mr. Hochstein, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
In President Biden's farewell address to the nation, he warned about a threat to American democracy, an incoming government run by billionaires. That's next time on Here and Now.
NPR is on the radio, online, and at your fingertips, wherever you go. Stay connected. Take the news with you on your smartphone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. What do you call a goose that's 10,000 feet above sea level? Lost? U.S. Forest Service rangers found that bird shivering in the snow on Northern California's Mount Shasta. The Forest Service said on social media that this particular climber only wore one layer of down and was unprepared for the freezing temperature and overnight camping, so the rangers gave it a ride to a pond at lower elevations. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. For more than 75 years, AU has supported freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more at au.org/NPR. From Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Severance returns for a second season today. That's the drama series about people whose memories are severed between work and home. NPR TV critic Eric Deggan says the show digs into its oddball premise this season to produce some of the year's weirdest and most adventurous TV.
To understand the second season of Severance, know this. When the characters undergo a procedure where they can only remember what happens at work when they're in the office, they essentially become two people in the same body. In the first season, each character recorded a message to themselves explaining how it all worked.
I give consent for my perceptual chronologies to be surgically split, separating my memories between my work life and my personal life.
At the end of Severance's last season, which debuted nearly 3 years ago, three of the inside consciousnesses, they're known as innies, snuck outside their office at the mysterious Lumen Industries. One of them addressed a corporate function, telling the world what was really going on.
And everything they told you about Severance is a lie. We're not happy. We're miserable. We're prisoners!
Got that? Because that's important to keep in mind as Severance's second season begins. The season leans into the tribulations of the innies, office drones who only know a life of meaningless tasks in a windowless room working from 9 to 5. Adam Scott's character, Mark Scout, was one of the innies who snuck outside last season. In the first episode of this new season, he's working with a new team of co-workers, including one played by Aaliyah Shawkat, who wants to know what the Audi world was like.
Did you really see the Audi world?
Yeah.
How's the sky?
I don't know.
What, you didn't see it?
Well, I went outside for a second, but I was distracted by my brother-in-law.
Seriously? Because we made a list of what we'd most like to see on the outside. Brothers-in-law weren't even on the list.
This season of Severance looks closer at the ramifications of creating severed people. I'm not sure they've really explained how people with limited memories know English but can't remember what the sky looks like. Anyway, Severance tells its story with a bold, absurdist flair, fueled by stark visuals developed by director-executive producer Ben Stiller. One moment, Mark is charging through an endless succession of white, featureless corridors with a slinky jazz score ratcheting up the tension. The next moment, he's stuck in a team-building exercise with his new supervisor, who happens to be a preteen girl.
My name is Miss Huang. It's my first day here. Something about me is that before this, I was a crossing guard.
Why are you a child?
Because of when I was born.
When any Mark tries to explain why he wants to find a woman in the office who was married to his outside consciousness, he gets a surprising response from his co-worker, Helly, played by Brett Lauer.
You know, we're the same-ish person, so it's mushy.
It's mushy? Is that what it is? We're not the same, actually. Us and the Audis, we're not. And speaking for myself, I don't think we owe them.
Helly's outside consciousness, by the way, is the daughter of Lumen Industries' CEO. Severance's odd storytelling touches keep the characters and viewers off balance, while serving up new mysteries and satirizing everything from ruthless corporate overlords to how terrible middle management jobs can be. It's a deliciously mind-bending array of mysteries that I don't want to spoil here. Just don't be surprised if it takes more than one viewing to understand it all. I'm Eric Deggans.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
The highest court in the land just ruled this weekend's TikTok shutoff is legal.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Clear Channel Outdoor, offering a nationwide network of billboards and data solutions that help businesses build brand awareness and influence consumer behavior. Billboardsforbusiness.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. The U.S. Supreme Court just now upheld a law that requires the pervasive short video app TikTok to be sold by its Chinese parent company to a U.S. company by Sunday or get turned off for U.S. consumers on Sunday. The bipartisan concern is that Chinese officials could target Americans with propaganda and disinformation or weaponize the personal data of Americans. Nearly half of the people in the U.S. use the short video platform. Marketplace's Washington correspondent Nancy Marshall Genzer joins us now live for what could come next.
Yeah, David, if TikTok isn't sold to a non-Chinese owner by this Sunday, it will basically cease to operate. I mean, you could still use the app in theory. It's just that U.S. companies are barred from distributing or updating it, and they would face huge fines if they did. A TikTok lawyer told the Supreme Court earlier that it would actually go dark on Sunday if the law was upheld. There are some reports that starting Sunday, if you do try to use TikTok, you will be redirected to a website about the ban.
Now, about 170 million people use the platform. Some, you've seen them, with great passion. Could yes. President Biden or President-elect Trump do anything?
Well, the Associated Press is reporting the Biden administration will not enforce the ban, and that pretty much leaves TikTok's fate up to the incoming Trump administration. It is unclear, though, how or if Trump would do that. He could issue an executive order to suspend enforcement of the ban, though.
All right. And this law, you covered it. It got bipartisan support last April.
It did. You know, supporters of the law said the Chinese government holds a small share in TikTok, and they are afraid, as you said, that China could force TikTok to hand over information on its users. It does collect a lot of data on them, or that Beijing could use the app to push disinformation.
All right, Nancy, thank you. Markets. The Dow, let's check, is up 388 points, 0.9%. The S&P is up 0.8%. The NASDAQ is up 1.5%. General Motors has been banned from sharing or selling data on the behavior of GM drivers for 5 years. It's a settlement with the Federal Trade Commission for what regulators say was a misleading sign-up system for something called Smart Driver, part of OnStar, linking GM cars to the cloud. GM sold data about speeding or late-night driving, for instance, to intermediaries, where it affected drivers' insurance rates and credit scores.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is currently looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who are interested in building a career and joining an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
With surveys not complete, authorities count about 12,000 structures destroyed in the Southern California wildfires. Rehousing and rebuilding involves insurance in most cases, and these disasters came at a time the insurance market in that state was in flux. This weekend, California officials are launching a new effort to help people navigate the insurance maze. Ricardo Lara is California's insurance commissioner. He spoke with my colleague Novo Safo.
The claims process, that's top of mind right now. What can people expect?
What we are looking at is making sure that the claims are paid fully, fairly, and as quickly as possible. That is my goal. And we've put insurance companies on notice to do the right thing during this crisis and support their customers, that many of whom have been with them for years, paying their premiums fully and on time. You're going to see insurance companies either reaching out personally to their consumers and also setting up disaster vans to be able to access their consumers as well. We are working on these insurance workshops, and this is really important because these are one-on-one with wildfire survivors. We do appointments with them and we connect them to their insurance representatives that are all in one room so that we can get the claims process quickly moving and hopefully get them paid as quickly as possible. So we're urging people to call us at 1-800-927-4357 to make an appointment. We'll take walk-ins, but we really want to have people call our department so we can assess their policy, make sure they got the documents they need. If not, we can get those so that we again get them through the claims process as seamlessly as possible.
What does paid fully and fairly look like?
Well, you know, that all depends, right? We want to make sure that whatever the consumers signed with an insurance company that the insurance company is contractually obligated to meet the terms of that contract. And those are going to be, you know, different by individual and by region, but that is my goal and my commitment to consumers, to make sure that the insurance companies meet that contractual obligation to the individual consumers.
Insurance payouts could be offered way before people know how much it will cost them to rebuild. How are they supposed to decide whether to accept a payout offer or not?
That is a great question. And this is something that we want to make sure we keep Angelenos on their toes in terms of making sure that when you're working with an adjuster, that it's an adjuster that knows what they're doing. You know, we are approving some out-of-state adjusters, but we are making sure that they understand what the rights are to the consumer. And so what we are recommending to consumers as they're going through the adjuster process, one, make sure that they're legitimate. You can, again, call our number. We can do that verification for you. What we're also telling consumers, take your time. Don't sign anything under duress. Be leery of people soliciting you, especially on the site. That's important. And one of the things that we're also telling folks is, you know, as volunteers are cleaning these sites, make sure that you take pictures before so that we have visual confirmation of the damage and the insurance company cannot fight you on that. We're also telling people you might want to create a separate email that is just dedicated to the claims process. So you have a documentation of your entire communications with your insurance company, with your adjuster. Should something go wrong or you feel that you're not getting what the insurance company is contractually obligated to give you, we can access that data on your behalf and make sure that we make them whole. And if they don't, that also serves us to go after them legally.
That's California's insurance commissioner, Ricardo Lara. He mentioned that phone number. Best way to get that is do an online search for the words California Insurance Commissioner Hotline. And I see that number just pops up. Among our interviews this week, we also heard from a representative of the insurance industry about all this. Marketplace.org has an on-demand version. I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.